Can this be my favorite song? Is that okay?
Sure.
All right, don't tell anybody. We're going to deal with a four-letter word, wait. What a terrible word. Nobody likes that word. And yet, that's how the psalm will start off. I waited. Wow. It's really been kind of building up to this point. There's so many places in the psalm the word wait is really revealed. If you go back to Psalm chapter 25, just to give you an example of this. We'll start off in verse 1. To thee, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in thee I trust. Do not let me be ashamed. Do not let my enemies exalt over me. Indeed, none of those who wait for thee will be ashamed. Those who deal treacherously without cause will be ashamed. Verse 5. Lead me in thy truth and teach me, for thou art the God of my salvation. For thee I wait all the day. Verse 21. Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for thee. If you look with me in 27, chapter 27, and verse 14, how does he end that particular chapter? Wait. O the Lord, be strong, let your heart take courage. Yes, wait, O the Lord. So by the time you get to, of course, chapter 37, we're getting closer to the wonderful passage of Psalm 40. Chapter 37 and verse 7, rest in the Lord, wait. Okay, now it's even going to tell you how to wait, isn't it? Wait patiently for him. Fret not because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Just wait. Then in verse 9, evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. And then, of course, as he says in verse 34 of that chapter, 37, wait for the Lord, keep his way. He will exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you will see it. So 39, verse 7, and now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in thee. Wait. Wait is clearly something that we don't like to do, but wait reveals so many things, doesn't it? I mean, it reveals a lot about us. It reveals how much we trust God. I mean, if you say you trust God, but you only trust him for the next second, if he comes through the next minute, then, okay, that's not really trust. In fact, the longer that you have to wait, the greater the trust, isn't it? And I would say, what I've seen throughout Scripture, the greater the reward. If you have to wait close to 100 years to have a baby, then it's a great reward for that one, isn't there? I'm not encouraging you all to wait that long. I know that waiting reveals the depth of love. If you're willing to wait for somebody, you're willing to be patient, then you realize that, okay, that person really loves that person. And I think it's one of the reasons why God has us wait. It begins to reveal, waiting begins to reveal where you have your hope. What is your hope in? Well, just let there be a waiting time. We'll find out. We'll find out. We'll find out where you go, what you run to, what you embrace during those long, long, arduous days. Waiting will reveal how patient you are, and it will reveal what you really believe. What do you really believe? Waiting has so many wonderful traits about it. Waiting also has a way of exhausting all human options. Because it's in the process of waiting that you begin to work through, you know, those other venues of trust. And that period of time, you begin to realize, okay, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. That's not going to work. And in many respects, when we come to this particular passage, I feel that though it really hasn't become solidified with the theologians where this particular Psalms comes out of in the life of David, I'm just going to have to put it right smack and dab in the middle of 1 Samuel 30. Because it was a time in which David finally waited on the Lord. It is not something that any of us want to do. And I think one of the things about David is that he fails so tremendously that everybody can see exactly what he's going through and what he's doing. And he does that for us. Scripture says these things were written for examples for us, that we might not do many of the things that they did. And so, you know, David just does everything so large that you go, okay, so somebody's been through this with me. So if you've ever had problems with waiting, join the club. But rest assured, God is bringing you to this point of, I waited. And there is a great victory. If you look with me in 1 Samuel chapter 30, if I can kind of introduce it this way, we come to a time in David's life where he really has exhausted almost everything that he can exhaust by virtue of options. And now he finds himself having no more options, really having absolutely no more options. And it is at this point that we begin to see David come to terms with, okay, what do I really believe? And who am I really going to trust? Now, just to kind of set up the text, we know that David in his early years, as he was a young lad out in the field, keeping watch over the flock, sometimes by night, he wanted to please. It's pretty obvious, according to the passage. He wanted to please his fathers. He wanted to somehow please his brothers. When he hears about Goliath, he runs. He's bringing food to his brothers. And I think his hope in some way is that, you know, he's gonna be a part of everything. And so he comes, and of course, he doesn't understand why this guy is getting away with slandering God. So he says something, and his brothers go, "You idiot. Back away, you know. Of course, you know, you're the youngest. What do you know?" kind of thing. Then, of course, David ends up kind of saying, "Well, what'd I say? What'd I say? I didn't say anything wrong. He shouldn't be doing that, right?" And they go, "Well, you just don't understand. I mean, he's really bigger than you guys are." So, but, you know, he just wanted to please them. And, of course, when it comes down to, well, somebody's got to do something, and he finds himself in front of this giant, you don't get the sense that David, at this young age, though I believe that he was zealous for God, you don't get the sense that he really was doing this solely for God. Even in the argument that he stands before Saul and he goes, "Look, I've done bears and I've done lions. I think I can handle this guy." I mean, this doesn't sound like truly rooted in faith. This is some kind of prowess, and, you know, it's youth going, you know, "Let's hit him with a stone. You know, he can't chase me down. I'm faster than him." You know? So he does. He does what he does, and sure enough, God blessed him because I believe, you know, in his zealousness and his desire to fend for God, God saw it was youth, and he goes, "Okay, we're going to knock this guy out." And it was all part of the process of God preserving him to be king and God pulling him out. Of course, the day comes when David wants to build God a house and God goes, "Okay, did you forget I was the one that took you out of that place? And I was the one that made you great." But David becomes a great warrior, and as he becomes a great warrior, we realize that the main reason that he's fighting is to please Saul. Just like he was wanting to show himself strong before his brothers, he's wanting to please Saul, and he can't understand why he can't do that. But as you watch him through the process of trying to please Saul, there are 1,001 things that he tries to do. He sings for him, remember? He sings for him, and he calms the savage beast. He tries to impress him by virtue of the battles. Didn't I kill these guys for you? Of course, he then tries to please him, as Saul says, you can have my daughter if you know you kill these guys. And he goes, okay, I'll do that. So he does it, and you know, he tries to please him. It seems like almost everything he tries to do, whether it's impressing or pleasing, or in some cases, he'll plead with them and say, why don't you like me? I really like you. Why don't you like me? It just doesn't seem to be working. And it's like he's exhausting all of these. I mean, he'll run from Saul, and then he'll give Saul another chance. I could have killed you, Saul, but I didn't. And Saul goes, you're my son. You know I've always loved you. And David goes, me too. I don't trust you, but me too. So he doesn't go there. And he hides from Saul, and he appeals as a son to Saul, even through Jonathan. He tries almost every single venue that he possibly can. But he finally comes to the point of realizing that I don't think he's going to like me, ever. That's an interesting point to come to, because the one thing that he really wanted was to be accepted into this kingdom, and he was not. In fact, if you back up into 1 Samuel chapter 27, just back up a few chapters, we actually get to hear David thinking to himself. And it reads this way in 1 Samuel 27, verse 1, then David said to himself, now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. He's now prognosticating and really prophesying what's going to happen. Have you ever had one of those moments? Okay, I know what's going to happen. You know, what is it? The worst that could ever happen. It's the worst that could ever happen. That's what's going to happen. So there's nothing better for me than to escape into the hand of the Philistines. This is David, for the first time, working through a plan B. It's actually plan B. He's pursued his dream, and he's hit it at almost every conceivable angle. It's not working. He finally goes, I'm not going to be king. I've been anointed king. God told me I was going to be king. I'm not going to be king. He's going to kill me. I'm not going to live to see the day. And until he kills me, in fact, why don't I give him a good reason to kill me? I'll go over to the Philistines. I'll be with them, and he'll be able to kill me while we're in battle. Maybe that's the way it was meant to be. So there's nothing better for me than to escape into the hands of the Philistines. Saul will then despair searching for me. And so he goes over to Achish, the king of one of the rulers of Philistines, and he makes a deal with him. And he starts going around killing other people, kind of for the Philistines. And so Achish comes up to him. He goes, so what you been doing for us Philistines? He goes, I've been killing a lot of people for you. And he goes, so who have you been killing? And if you drop on down, if it says in verse 8, now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gizites, the Amalekites, for they have been inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you come to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. And Daniel and David attacked them. So he was attacking those. Now, when they come and they ask him, when the Philistines come and they ask him, who have you been fighting? He doesn't tell them these guys, because these are the enemies of Judah. So he's figuring under the stealthiness of being with the Philistines, I'll kill the enemies of Judah, but I'll tell the Philistines that I'm killing my own people. So if you look, if you drop on down, it says in verse 10, now Achish said, where have you made a raid today? And David said, against the Negev of Judah. He hasn't been killing his own people. He hasn't been killing his own people. It just tells you in verse 8 who he's been killing. And against the Negev of the Jehemelites, which basically is a descendant of Judah's grandson. Against the Negev of the Kenites, which is the descendants of Moses' kin. So he's and so the king says, well, David must be on our side. So David's kind of living, you know, undercover. He's doing things that he thinks is a good thing to do, but he's lying about it. And so, you know, you can lie as long as you're doing something good, right? But it's basically David waiting. And it's an interesting description, because we all wait most of the time wrong. The way we wait is not correct. And though we can rationalize it and justify it, it's really not appropriate, because it's not trusting on God. It's not waiting on Him. And the way most of us perceive waiting is, sometimes we perceive waiting as doing nothing. Sometimes we perceive waiting and do the wrong thing, which obviously is not right. But even as erroneous as that, sometimes we perceive waiting as doing a good thing without it really being God's thing. And that's where we take some really bad turns. The things that David's doing is nothing that God has told him to do. It's kind of on his own. It's kind of off the cuff, off the top of his head. He's got an idea. I mean, as long as I'm here, I might as well be getting rid of some of these bad people in the land. I'll do it under the cover of being with the Philistines. I'll tell them that I'm killing my own people, and they're going to like that. They're going to like me more. And so that's him kind of working through the waiting. And I think that's what we do. We kind of work through the waiting, and we finally, you know, okay. It's not going to work out exactly the way that we thought it would, in the sense of God really coming through for us. Because if God was really going to come through, He would have already done it, right? I mean, He wouldn't have made us wait that long. Or like Lazarus, He wouldn't have waited till he died. That's ridiculous. Nobody would wait that long. So, you know, because God really didn't come through, we'll give Him a little bit of help. We'll give Him a plan B. We'll say that we're waiting on Him. So he goes to the general of the Philistines, and he goes, I hear you guys are going off to war, by the time we get to chapter 30. And he goes, yeah, we're going to war. We're going to go war against Israel. He goes, I'm going to go with you. I'll back you up. And so Achish goes, well, you've made yourself odious with your own people already. I think we can trust you. But all the other generals of the Philistines were going, I don't want this guy. We know who David is. He's killed giants. He's been our enemy for a long time. I don't want him on my back. I don't want to have to trust this guy. Achish goes, you can trust him. You can trust him. I mean, this guy's on the level. He'll fight with us. And they said, no, he's not going. So now David, talk about low. You didn't think you'd get any lower? Okay, now the enemy is turning him away. The enemy is saying, we don't even want you. So you got a warrior that's out of work. I mean, if you can't kill any people, then, I mean, what do you do? It's so hard to get a job. So as you come to 1 Samuel 30, it's under these circumstances in which David, it says, if you look with me, it says in verse 1, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag. Now, this is the territory that the Philistines had given him to live in the meantime, when he's waiting on God to do whatever God's going to do, which, by the way, God didn't tell him to go live there. But that's where he went, and this is what he's doing. So it happened when he goes back, because the Philistines told him, go home. We don't want you going with us. So he goes home. And when he goes home, and you might want to mark it in Scripture, it was on what day?
Third day.
That's pretty interesting. Not a mistake. That the Amalekites made a raid on the Negev. That's the southern part of Judah, is what he's talking about. On and in the village of Ziklag. And it's an interesting word, because by itself it seems to have the connotation of a rushing, like a rushing water, a rushing wind or something. You might just want to kind of keep that in the back of your mind. But that was the village in which he had his family, and his warriors had their families, and so they had come in the meantime and had ransacked his village where his family was. And they had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire, and they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. Isn't that the graces of God? Without killing anyone. Now, these are the Amalekites, and I don't want to go too much into the background of this, but the Amalekites were the people that God had told Saul to make sure you wipe everybody out. And obviously Saul kept at least the Agagite family, which will come later with Haman and Esther, and we won't go into that. The Amalekites, if you go all the way back to Exodus in chapter 17, were the ones that raided the Israelites as they were trying to come through and come out of Egypt. And God says, for this, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. You're not going to live because of that. I'm going to wipe you out. And that was one of the reasons why he told Saul, wipe out this nation, because they tried to get you when you were coming out of. So you see him pop back up in Numbers chapter 14. And again, you know, they actually go in and begin to wipe out the people, and it's at a time in which the people are complaining against God, and God's not saving them. So they have a history of being a mess. What's interesting is Amalekites were like vagabonds. They really didn't have cities per se. They lived in tents, and they attacked, and they were real good at what they did. They were kind of terrorist type of people. And so their name actually means valley dwellers. And they're an interesting picture of that, as we'll go on to see. But so they came in and they raided and took captive everybody without killing anybody, which, it said, it's a miracle in and of itself. And then David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned. Can you imagine coming to your home and the home is just completely burned down? You don't know what's really happened. Can you imagine what's rushing through somebody's head when he knows he was someplace where he shouldn't have been? And his family is now gone because he hasn't been doing what he should have done? Well, if that's not bad enough, it says within the passage, their wives and the sons and their daughters have been taken captive. And in verse 4, David and the people who were with him lifted their voices. They began to weep until there was no strength left in them. It's bad enough that you're sad, but you made everybody else sad. That's a terrible moment to be. And it says, now David's two wives have been taken captive as well. And it says in verse 6, moreover, David was greatly distressed, because his own people, these are his most loyal soldiers, his own people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And verse 7 reads this way, Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Bring me the ephod." So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this band?" Now that's an obvious axiomatic thing. Yes, pursue them. They have your kids. They have your wife. Yes. Why ask God? Because David has come to the point, you know what? I don't know what to do. Even when you know what to do, I don't know what to do. I'm not going to trust myself because everything I've been doing, you know, I've been trying to do good. But if you think about it, it's the Amalekites that are coming and invading, right? If you go back to 27, who had he attacked? And he wiped out man, woman, child. And that was his own idea. That wasn't God saying, go wipe them out. That was his own idea. Now they've gone in, they've taken his kids and his wife and all the soldiers' kids and wives. And whose fault was it? It's his. Now his own people are getting ready to kill him. He doesn't have a second to waste because they're picking up stones. And he says, wait, I'm going to talk to the priest. Now, nothing's stopping them from throwing rocks right now. Shall I overtake them? And he said, yes, pursue them. Surely you will overtake them. At a time when it really didn't pay him to wait, he was going to wait. And the Amalekites, interestingly enough, in almost every setting that you see them come in, it's directly connected with the people of God waiting or not waiting. If you remember in Exodus 17, when we first see them come in to attack the people of God, it's right after the people wouldn't wait because they got thirsty. They were thirsty in the desert, and they began to complain against God. Therefore, God called this the place of bitterness. And it was right after that the Amalekites come in and begin to attack. The same thing is true in Numbers chapter 14. The same thing is true with the fact that Saul not wait upon the Lord, did not obey what the Lord told him to do in that particular text in 1 Samuel 15. And God says, didn't I tell you to obey is better than sacrifice? They're always connected. And what's interesting is they are called valley dwellers, which is basically what their name means. It's in the context almost always of when we're in the valley, or we'll put it another way, when we're feeling really low. You know, when things are not working out well, when we're thirsty, when we're upset, when we're hot and bothered, or when disappointment has overwhelmed us, in the midst of that valley, that's when the attacks always start coming, right? Because things aren't working out the way that they should be working out. David finally comes to the point, and he said, I waited. And I believe in many respects, that's where this psalm comes into play. That he came to a place in which he goes, I'm going to wait. Now, the psalm is actually going to tell us what we're waiting for and how to wait. So that's one of the reasons why the psalm is so important. Because, one, we're not good at waiting. Two, when we do wait, we don't do it right. So this psalm is going to say it does pay off. And the waiting has a purpose. And so he begins to convey that. So if you look with me in Psalm chapter 40, we'll begin to see this wonderful truth as we look in this passage. Psalm chapter 40, verse 1. I waited patiently. That's an art, isn't it? That's an art. The emphasis, obviously, is in the expectancy of it all. Because you actually believe something wonderful is going to happen. The patient is really a result of believing, isn't it? I mean, it's impossible for you to do that without. But because it's in the infinitive, it's kind of the persona. It's who I became. Let's see if I can describe it this way. I became a patient waiter. It's one thing to wait patiently. It's quite another thing to become a patient person who waits continually for God. And there seems to be this. I made it. I know this is what I need to do. And if you look in the passage, he inclined to me. I always love when I see that because it has this wonderful picture. Of course, God's in heaven, you know, right? And how wonderfully grand he is. I was talking to my mother today. She goes, do you ever think about what God looks like? And I said, Mom, every time I think about what God looks like, I said, I can't help but think of Isaiah 6. I said, immediately my head goes to Isaiah 6, where it talks about the train of his robe is just flowing through the heavens. Can you imagine? It's probably hitting some stars. You know, some galaxies are moving as his train is just flowing. And the angels around him are going, there's nobody like this guy. There's nobody like him. You know? And how convincing they must be. As the seraphim, by their very name, means flaming ones. So you've got these lightning bolts. And literally, you can hear them whispering. There's no one like him. It's amazing. What an amazing picture. But the grandeur of God, to me, the greatest picture that I can see of him is probably this phrase. Because it literally means he bent down. The grand God of the universe leans down to me. Why? This is very important. Because I waited patiently for him. There is a great reward in waiting patiently for him. It is he bends down. The psalmist will say a little bit later on in Psalm 116:1, I love the Lord because he hears me. And who really listens to anybody nowadays? But God, you can just see him leaning down and bending down and going, so what did you want to say? I can just see him doing that. And he inclined to me and he heard my cry. The emphasis, of course, is that he knew what I was upset about because he heard. We oftentimes talked as parents, or Connie and I were talking. We could tell the voice of our children when they were crying, if they were just upset, if they were angry at us, if in fact they were hurt. You could hear a certain cry. He recognized what was going on, and he brought me up out of the pit. Watch the phrase. Out of the pit of what? Destruction. And the reason why I point to that particular word, you remember where David was living, that little village, Ziklag, was it? Which meant rushing. Well, this particular word gives the inference of a tumult rushing. There are things that happen in our life that just are so overwhelming. And if you can picture, I mean, you're already disappointed. You're about as far into the valley as you can get because you've been turned down by everything. You've just given up the fact that you're ever going to be king. You've been now with the Philistines 1 year and 4 months. That's stated in chapter 27 of 1 Samuel. He was with the Philistines 1 year and 4 months. That's a long time. So, so on top of that, he now is rejected by the Philistines as a viable option in war machine. And he's sent home. He's sent home. The great warrior David is sent home. Go home. Go home. And when you come home, everything's burned. Now, how do you feel? How are you feeling? I mean, there's nothing that can explain that. It's like feelings rushing upon you, and these people had rushed in there and just literally taken everything. I mean, you like losing your breath. You can't catch your breath. He brought me out of the pit of the tumult of the rushing and out of the miry clay. It's an interesting combination because the picture is being stuck in mud while rushing tumult is coming. Okay, you're not going anywhere. This is just there's nowhere to go. You're dead. You're drowned. And he set my feet upon a rock. And he made my goings, is actually the way that that's worded. Which David is saying, you know, I may not have been going in the right direction. But the way that I was going, he still saved me. He took me. He put me on a place of stability and security and safety, even though he knew where I was going. He knew the place that I was going. I mean, obviously, the way that he was going was not an appropriate way to go, but he put me in a firm place. He fixed my goings, and he put a new song in my mouth. It was like for the first time in years, he felt hope. I mean, that's one of the problems of difficulties that come in our life, that, you know, you get in that valley, you get stuck, and then after a while you feel like your feet are stuck and you can't move, and then you see the only thing you can see is the difficulties rushing on you, and you go, this isn't going to end well. And then God just, and you go, I don't deserve this. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know how I got here. But he saved me. I mean, it's one of the greatest moments, if you've ever experienced it in your life, because you know that there was nothing, absolutely nothing, that you did to deserve that moment. And yet, he took care of all those bad turns. And almost in a moment, it was gone. It's like changed. He put a fresh and exuberant, unheard song from my mouth. I can't, it's been years since I sung how wonderful God is. I think I even forgot how to praise. And he uses that wonderful word that deals with the fact that you're celebrating. And I don't think he'd been celebrating for a long time, do you? Celebration and exuberation and laudable praise and adoration for God. Many will see, I love the way that he puts this, many will see and fear and will trust in the Lord. Now this is a very interesting text to me, because what it's conveying is when you've experienced a salvation such as that, it so changes your demeanor that you're almost unrecognizable. People were going, is that you? Sort of like the blind man. Is that the blind man? No, that's not the blind man. No, it's me. No, it's not the blind. It's not you. No, it is me. No, it's not you. We know who you are, and you're not you. So. But you realize God's transformation in somebody's heart, and like the woman at the well, you become so convincing because of what's happened to you. You begin to realize that this moment had a great purpose in it. And one of the great purposes is to let people know how God can save no matter what. Because that's the great message that we have to people that are hurting today. I mean, you talk to them and you go, yeah, but you don't know what's happened in my life. And then we just simply say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He can change everything instantly. And, you know, what a wonderful, I mean, it's just an amazing truth. I think of oftentimes Luke chapter 5 with Peter, and there he goes and, you know, cast your net out. Well, we fished all night. It's not going to happen. It's noonday. It's not a good time to go fishing. Go ahead and do it anyway. And he does. And then he catches so many fish, he can't bring them in. He just falls on his face and he goes, wow. You know, it's just one of those moments. And those are life-changing moments that cause you to be convincing. I was talking to somebody last week and I said, you know, when you're sharing the gospel, they need to see it being real in you. Because if they don't see that it's exciting in your life, then why would they fear God? Why would they go, whoa, that something really happened here? But most of the time, the way we share Christ, it's like we're trying to sell Amway or something. And we're not getting across. We don't really want to be there. It's just soap. But what we have is something far greater than that, isn't it? And it has changed our lives. Hasn't it changed our lives? These moments of difficulty, if in fact you've never been pulled out of the miry clay, I get it. You can't be convincing. You can't be. But if you have, you can't be quiet. And so convincing you are that many will see. He actually uses a word, they'll perceive and regard highly what they see. They go, it's change. The person's changed. That had to be God. Nobody could do that except God. Many will see and fear the Lord and will trust in him just because of what they heard from you. It's an amazing text. How happy, how blessed, how wonderful is the man who has made the Lord his trust, his confidence, and his security. He has not turned to what?
To the proud.
Yeah. Okay, the proud goes, I got this. I can do this for you. I think I can take care of this. You know, the arrogance of man, he's always got a solution. He goes, it's an interesting picture. He says, I didn't turn my face. It's actually the way it reads. I would not turn my face to talk with the proud. There's a tendency to go around and begin to, well, you're testing out your options, right? You're testing out your options. So you're trying to work through, and so somebody says, hey, I have an idea, and then all you have to do is do this. But you know what he said? I heard him say, I had an idea. I wouldn't even turn to him. Because I know I've been down that road. There are no more ideas. There's only one. So I'm not even going to look. And in a way, he's describing waiting. See, waiting is not you weighing out your options. It's not you saying, well, if God doesn't really come through, I've got plan B. It's you going, it's only God. And I'm not going to listen any other way. And I'm not going to turn to them, if you look in the passage, nor am I going to go with those who lapse into deceptive. Well, he'd already kind of gone down that path. You know, he tells the Philistine king, I'm really killing these people, but I'm secretly killing these people. And, you know, he's been working every angle that he can think of. The reason why we love David so much is because he's tried it all. You know? And he finally comes up to this place and goes, believe me, it's not going to work. Don't even go there. Don't try to fake it. Don't try to deceive. Don't try to think through. Don't go there. Nor to those who lapse into falsehood. Many, O Lord, my God, watch the phrase, are the wonders which thou hast done. Now, you need to understand what he's saying here. So let's just take it slowly. Many, O Lord, are the wonders which thou hast done. Now, the reason that he uses the word wonders there is because the deep connotation of the word itself is, you do things I don't understand. And that's an interesting point because when you're going through these trials and the testing, you're going, all right, none of this makes sense to me. And God goes, I got a whole universe of that. So the passage is saying is, everything you do, God, there's nothing I understand. If you understand what he's saying here, because the main problem with waiting is you're trying to figure out the whole thing. You're trying to work through the process, and you're going, okay, so, okay, this is what he's doing. I think I got it. And right when you think you got it, you don't got it. And so you find yourself frustrated and angry, and God, you took a wrong turn. And God goes, you're not even in the neighborhood. So many, O Lord, are the things beyond my comprehension, would be the best way to put that, that you have done. Now, the reason why that's in the perfect tense is telling us this. And remember, perfect tense is a completed action with a resulting state of being. That means that though on the cross, God says, it is finished. That's a completed action. But the results of that is he brings many sons to glory, and someday he will reign. Now, when was it finished? Then. But the resulting state of being begins to come. So what he's stating is everything you've done, it's already done. We're just reaping the resulting state of being of it. That's a very interesting point. I don't understand anything you're doing. God goes, well, that's too bad because I've already done it. See, no matter what is happening, it's already been done. It's forever thy word is settled in heaven, he says. I take great comfort in that because that means that nothing wrong can happen. That God is causing all things to work together for good. Amen. So, many, O Lord, my God, are thy wonders which thou hast done, and thy thoughts toward us. Now, you got to underline the word thoughts. Because it's not just talking about the fact that God is, you know, thinking, okay, they bought groceries today. He's not just thinking that. Many, O Lord, are the intent and the purposes and the plans that you have for us. There are many things that God has orchestrated that we are meant to do. And this is the point of this phrase. God, I know that you have everything lined out. There are 1,001 things that you have made for me to accomplish. I don't know what they are. I don't even know how to get there. I don't even know what you're doing. But I know there are a lot of them. And there is none that compares, if you look at the passage, with thee. In other words, the word compare within the text is dealing with putting things in arrangement and order. And what it's saying is that no one could really, as many things as the purpose and the plans and the, you know, intent that you have towards me, because there are so many of those things, even if you were to tell me what they all are, I couldn't put them in the right order. I wouldn't even know where to begin. There's none to compare or order these things like you could. So when he says none to compare with thee, he's actually saying nobody could put them in order like you could. Nobody could arrange these things like you could. I mean, it, just imagine if God were to sit you down when you're, I don't know, 5 years old, and he says, okay, so the rest of your life, this is what I want you to do. And you go, okay, so when do I do that? And how do I do that? And, I mean, you couldn't. How could you? The psalmist is coming to terms with, I know that God has worked all these things out. I have no idea. I guess I'm just going to have to trust him. So there's none to compare with him. If I would declare them, if I try to explain what God was doing, it would be, first of all, too numerous, but he can also put in the text, far too great for me to comprehend. The word numerous is there. It's just as much too great. It's too magnificent. There's just no way that I... I mean, I could talk about them, but I wouldn't know what I was talking about. I wouldn't know how to explain it to somebody. You just walk up. I could just see Noah walking up to his mom. Okay, Mom, I'm gonna build a boat. Why? There's gonna be a flood. When? Not sure. What's a boat? I mean, there are things that you. How could you explain such a thing? And we're gonna take all the animals in. I mean, you don't even want to go there with your mom. So, if I would declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count. Verse 6. You know what? I've come to realize something. And that's where this whole text begins to change. Because as he's been going, he says, you know, it was the waiting patiently that caused me to finally come to something. Now let me just say this about waiting. There are things that God is doing, obviously, that we don't know what he's doing. There are dangers that he sees that we're involving ourselves in. I mean, when you take the particular incident with David, did he have any idea what was going on? He had no idea what was going on. Did he have any idea that within probably months he would be king? He had no idea that everything was almost going to change overnight. But David had already written everything off because things weren't working the way that he thought they should work. David is conveying, you know what you need to do? You need to quit figuring out what you think is best. Because that's, when you think about it, that's the problem with our waiting. And let me see if I can explain this as simply as I can to define to you exactly what waiting is about. Waiting is that thing that comes in. When God says, wait on me, this is what he's telling you. Stop doing what you're doing. He's not telling you to stop doing everything, because he's going to have you do something. But he's telling you stop doing what you're doing. Because the problem of where we are is going against where he wants us and what he's doing for us and what he's been planning for us. So many things God has in store for us. We have our own agenda. So let's say in David's life, his whole agenda is to get Saul to like him. How does that match up with God's agenda? It doesn't. Because if, in fact, he gets what he wants, he'll never be king. And he'll never be the lineage of the Messiah, nor have the blessings that David was meant to have. David not only would have settled for second best, he would have settled for worse. And it was all because he wanted it. Most of the things that you're going after, most of the things that I'm going after are destructive. And I can tell you the reason why that's true. Because our thoughts are not his thoughts. As high as the heavens are above the earth, so are his ways higher than ours. So I can guarantee you, if you have a thought, it's not his. I can guarantee that. And if you pursue that, so that in our life, we go through these scenarios in our heads. We say to ourselves, well, the worst that could happen is Saul doesn't like me. Oh, that's the worst that can happen. That's not the worst that can happen. In fact, that's what needs to happen in order for all these other things to take place. And we get so frustrated because we're trying to make whatever that agenda it is that we are so in love with happen, that we think that God's on a wrong track. So he turns and he says this in verse 6. Sacrifice, and by the way, this particular phrase is used a number of places. It'll be quoted, obviously, in Hebrews, which we'll see the text that is really messianic, that is within the passage. But Psalm 51, he makes reference to this. It's mentioned in 1 Samuel, Isaiah 1. It's mentioned in Jeremiah 6, 7, Amos. Okay, so it must be a truism. So here's the text. Sacrifice and meal offering thou hast not desired. Now, sacrifice, obviously, we understand what that means. Meal offering is a tribute. God's not trying to get you to give him money. He's not trying to get you to give him anything. That's not what he's asking for. In fact, he goes on and he says, my ears thou hast opened. Now, here we're getting to the whole purpose of waiting. Because the problem is that in the midst of us doing whatever we do, we're not listening to God. We're talking to him, and we're trying to get him to do what we think he needs to do. And we got it all mapped out. And if you think about it, most of the time it's really good stuff. It's good stuff. I mean, you think about David. He's killing all the bad guys. But he's not killing the bad guys when God tells him to kill the bad guys. It's sort of like in Numbers 14. God says, okay, now I want you to go into the promised land. They go, we're scared. He goes, go anyway. We don't think so. And so then God says, okay, if you don't, you're going to get run over by the Amalekites if you don't obey me. So the Amalekites come in, and they just wreak havoc. And then they go, okay, that didn't work out. And they said, so we'll go in and kill the Amalekites. And he goes, no, you don't want to kill the Amalekites now. No, we'll do that. We'll kill the Amalekites. We'll go into the promised land. We'll go into the promised land like you told us to. Don't go in the promised land. We're going to go in the promised land. Okay. So they're going to, Amalekites, wipe them out again. So it may be a good thing, but it's not when God says to do it. Now you say, why is that? Well, timing is everything. There's a time and a season for everything under the sun, and God knows when that is, right? And you also know as well as I do that if you say the right thing at a wrong time, it can be misconstrued and can come back at you. So knowing, how do you know? You got to be taking your cues from somebody that knows what's going to happen and what the right time is. Ecclesiastes says you don't even know when the right time is. There is a time and a season for everything. You just don't know when it is. And that's why you got to know God, because there's no way you can figure this out. I mean, the universe has to be aligned in order for this to happen. So you come to this point, and there has to be the complete trust in him. So he's saying, you know what? I'm beginning to understand that some of the things that I thought God was wanting out of me were not the things that God was wanting at all. I thought it was all about the sacrifice. I thought it was all about me doing something for him. So, I'll put more money in the offering plate. You know, I'll do more work. And God says, would you just stop? See, that's what waiting's about. Just stop. Burn offering, as he goes on to say, burn offering, which is the best picture of burn offering, is everything going up in smoke. So that means everything. You, everything. It kind of reminds me of 1 Corinthians 13. If I give my body to be burned, that would be a burn offering. So burn offering is a picture of just a whole dedication. Everything going up in smoke. Nothing left to eat. Nothing left. Burn offering and sin offering, which is dealing with, okay, I did something wrong. I'll pay my debt. God says, I didn't even ask for you to pay. You know, okay, God, whatever you say, okay, all right, I'm wrong. I'll pay up. God goes, I didn't ask you to pay up. I'm doing that. Thou hast not required. Now, if you look at verse 7, it's like an epiphany. I got it. And this is what waiting is all about. Waiting is all about you getting it. It's about me getting it. Because Once again, if we're all honest with ourselves, in the process of waiting, first of all, we don't like it. Secondly, we try to work through all of the possibilities of maybe what we could do to get what we think needs to happen. I mean, the whole reason we're waiting is because we're not getting what we need, and we're waiting to get it. That's what we're thinking in our head. Of course, we wouldn't say that to God. We're just waiting on the Lord. But that's what we're thinking. So, okay, we're waiting on you to give us what we think we need at this moment. And so, man, you're late, but we're waiting. So, and we're happy about it. So, then I said, now, the said is actually an internal word. So he's talking to himself. And he's talking to himself by making a commitment to himself. So then I made a resolve. And then I came to him. Now the problem is that we're trying to get God to come to us, to walk down our path, to do what we want him to do. He goes, that's where I've been wrong. And this is the whole reason for waiting, is to get you on his path. Then I said, behold, I enter into you, your way. In the scroll, in the conglomerate, if you can think in terms of all of Scripture, in the conglomerate of all of Scripture of the book, it is written what you want of me. You go through trials, you go through tribulation, you go through hardship, you go through pain. You finally go, what? Unfortunately, up to this point, you really haven't been that attuned. But you finally go, what? And he goes, just stop doing what you're doing. Now, would you listen? And you go, that's right. I never asked you what you wanted. See, that's the whole game changer. Because we're so enthralled and immersed, and we think that our plan is going to make everything better. So going off with the Philistines, that's somehow going to make my life okay. And somewhere along the line, we settle for okay. We say to ourselves, you know, maybe okay is all that I was ever meant to experience. Maybe it was just okay. I mean, that's one of the great purposes of the book of Zechariah, right? Where we're in the ravine at the beginning of the book, but at the end of the book, God says, no, you were meant to be on the mountain. But the ravine, it's so cool and there's shade trees, and maybe that's where we're meant to be. Maybe the nations were meant to be over us. And he says, no, you were meant to be the greatest nation of all the nations. And God in his grace has far greater things for us than we would ever settle for ourselves. Sometimes our plans have to be snatched out from us. And it's that snatching out away from us that causes us so much heartache and pain. But it's really God saving us from the very things. I mean, can you imagine? David goes, you mean I can't fight for the Philistines? That's so disappointing. And you're going, David, 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 you're not even thinking right. And that's what he's going to be saying within the passage. I wasn't even thinking right. As I'll go on a little bit further. In the scroll of the book, it is written to me, I delight to do your will, O God. This is actually used as a quote there in Hebrews chapter 10 as that which is a quote of Christ. And I was thinking in particular, when you go back to Exodus 17 and then Numbers 14, in both those cases, you have the whole water scene, you know, where they're thirsty and they're not getting any water, so they begin to complain against God. And I think the initial thought is, you know, when you and I are thirsty, that God's just being mean. Isn't that the reason why you're thirsty? Isn't that the reason why you're having a difficult time? Because God's just not nice. He's not. I mean, and so what's your number one goal? Get something to drink. Everything else goes to the side. Manners goes to the side. Thankfulness goes to the side. What's your number one goal? I'm going to get something to drink. Do you know that Jesus is on the cross and he says, I thirst? Do you know why he says that? To show us that it's possible to believe that God is love when we're thirsty. See? And it's during those times that really create the greatest praise. And it's most convincing to those people that are surrounding us. If you can say God is good when you're thirsty, that's faith. It takes no faith for you to have lots of water and, okay, God is good. It takes no faith. But it shows the love and the trust of someone that if I'm thirsty, it's for a really good reason. And God is going to do something wonderful through this difficulty. But you know, most of the time when you're thirsty, you never ask him, what is it you want me to do? You don't ask him that. You say, why am I thirsty? I'm not supposed to be thirsty. When am I going to get a drink? And it's all these things that you throw at him. But you never stop to ask, what is it you want me to do? There's a reason why I'm thirsty. What is it you want me to do? The psalmist says, I came to this point and I said, you know what? That's what God wanted me to say all along. I come to do your will. Father, thy will be done. What is it? What is it you want? And once that begins to happen, you delight to do what God says and his word is on your heart, then you go, okay, I get why that happened. I get why this happened. I get why things moved the way that they did. I mean, up to that point, nothing makes sense. And this is the reason for Ecclesiastes, because he goes, I look under the sun, and he says, if you take God out of the picture, nothing makes any sense. But you put God in the picture, and you say, okay, God, what are you doing? Then God begins to reveal. Believe me, he'll reveal. If you'll come to him and just say, what are you wanting to accomplish? He'll begin to show you all the things that he's accomplishing and how wonderful they are. He says in verse 9 and 10, what's the result of this? I'm going to tell everybody. I'm not going to hide this. They're going to see the transparency of my heart. They're going to just see how wonderful you are. But he's also going to be conveying as well how difficult it is for me to maintain that mindset. And that's where he gets, if you look in particular in verses 11 and 12, this is where he begins to wrestle with that. And we'll talk about that as we come back next week. But what a wonderful place to come to, because there's this great transition that God is taking us into. And it's these difficulties. I was thinking, with my folks being here, we were talking about different times in our life. And my mom says, did you feel like you had a great childhood or a good childhood? And I said, oh, yeah, I had the greatest childhood, Mom. Said I had a great mom, and she said, were there any difficult times that you know? I said, well, I said it's interesting that she wanted to know if moving from West Virginia to Illinois was difficult. I said, well, I was still pretty young, and I said, you know, I kind of looked at it as an adventure, and I said it was kind of exciting to me there. I said, but it was traumatic. I had to play on your mother a little bit. I said, it was traumatic when I moved from Illinois to Florida. And I remember being very upset. I mean, we just lived in the perfect neighborhood. I mean the neighbors swept the streets. So they not only swept their sidewalk, they went out in their street. And the Swedish people, most of them, and they they swept their streets. But anyway, it was just a great neighborhood to live in and a great place to go. And then we moved down to Florida, and I go to a school and it has sulfur water. I mean, and we moved in a home that didn't have air conditioning, and we moved down in the middle of summer in Florida. The very next year, Hurricane Dora. So welcome to Florida, or heck, welcome to heck. My wife won't let me say the other word, but and then of course you had to have your windows open at night, and you got that wonderful muggy air coming in. And the guy across Neesmith, he had a big pond, and we called it Neesmith Pond. It was pretty inventive, wasn't it? And in the middle of the night, you got these frogs going. Like, and I remember telling my brother, I says, "We've died and gone to heck." But it was an interesting transition. God was getting me down here to find my wife. There were other things involved, but I can't think of anything greater that has happened to me outside of my salvation. I would have never, but she was the one for me. And I was clawing and complaining. And when I met her, I stopped complaining, though. But I wasn't thinking that. You understand what I'm saying? The only thing I was thinking is, I want to be here. And I had a reason for this, a legitimate reason. I could name them all. But none of them compared to what God was doing for me. And yet I was fighting that all the way. I'm glad that God was sovereignly working over in the realm of authority. And he does that in his graciousness. But God is doing a good work. And you shouldn't be asking, why are you doing this to me? You should be asking, what are you doing that I should be doing with you? I came to do your will. And once you get on there, everything becomes clear. Father, thank you for your goodness to us and your love for us. That just, it's inexplicable. I give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.